wanted to disabuse young romantics who are sort of solipsistic and narcissistic and believing in the sort of romantic notion of writing by inspiration. No, let's disabuse you of that. You're going to be pitted in a situation where people are going to try to find the worst in what you've written here and make you abundantly aware of how bad it is and how much work you have to do. And the thought was, according to his philosophy, he wanted you to lose blood in these workshop sessions, but as he said, not too much blood. And one says, well, how is this happening? Well, it's sort of a constellation of forces between the Cold War era, where he's sort of, you know, definitely showing the influence of this kind of militaristic approach, but also the fact that his own past comes from being the son of a horse breeder and trainer. And he felt that young writers were like young horses. They needed to be broken.
You say that Paul Engel turned participation in the writer's workshop into kind of a blood sport.
And writing would continue in that vein even after he left under Jack Leggett, and continue to be something of a blood sport where a lot of the male writers sort of perpetrated this kind of cult of boxing, where they would say you'd have to box several rounds a week to really prove your worth as a writer. Engel's sort of school of hard knocks, his delicate aggression, as he called it, was something that he wanted to instill so that writers would get a sense of what publishing would be like out in the real world, the kind of abuse they would have to take from critics, from editors, from reviewers out in the publishing industry and the literary marketplace. He wanted to simulate that in the workshop session, as he said, in the most aggressive manner possible, so that it would toughen them for that real world.
And he also was a big advocate of this new criticism where you would just pull everything apart, and it was very intense, wasn't it?
Yes. Well, the new criticism is interesting. It sort of arose at a time during the height of the Cold War, and definitely was a companion ideologically to Cold War logics, in the sense that, you know, the text mattered, not context. They were trying to very much depoliticize writing at this point, to assume that one could approach a literary text, whether it was your own writing or someone else's, as if it were somehow removed from the cultural condition in which it was produced, and that you could look at it like a specimen, like a scientific part of the body or something to anatomize. So this sort of cold, formalist, clinical approach was definitely new criticism. And writers were definitely forced to a kind of conform to this approach. And it sort of alienated many of them. W.D. Snodgrass, for example, was, you know, felt that he was being pushed to conform to this sort of writing by committee, what he called learned, symbol-laden poems that any good poetry committee could write. You know, he's saying, look, that was writing in some kind of voice, but it certainly wasn't my own. And I mean, it's sort of the joke that one fellow colleague of mine said was that, you know, during this time period, could one imagine Walt Whitman taking an MFA from the Iowa Writers' Workshop? You know, he espousing just exactly the opposite of this Cold War mentality, which was depersonalized writing. You know, Whitman being sort of the epitome of spontaneous, passionate, individualistic self-expression. All of that, though, was considered inferior at the workshop at this time.
In the book, you talk about Kurt Vonnegut coming to teach and how people had been very critical of his writing up until then, that he wrote paperbacks. The stuff he wrote wasn't the kind of thing that you would ever call literature, but he came to teach, and he had a very interesting trajectory, didn't he?
He did. He really did. So he's very funny, of course. He's Kurt Vonnegut. He's hilarious. He begins, you know, in any interview that he ever did, by saying, you know what, when I came to the workshop, nobody knew me. Nobody read my books. Most of my books were out of print. It's not that I was getting bad reviews. I wasn't getting any reviews. And he really was in a tailspin professionally when he came to the workshop. Pretty much thinking about becoming a Saab salesman, the automobile, right? So he gets a call to replace Robert Lowell from one of the second in command at the workshop. He comes out and he's desperately worried that he does not have the stuff to make it here among this very intimidating faculty and student body too. The publications are not only prolific, but they're very highly placed. Most of these people's work is considered literary, not, like you mentioned, not the pulp sort of trade fiction paperback that he had written most of the time. And especially in the vein of science fiction, no one had written in a popular genre like this at all. The workshop begins with Flannery O'Connor, and moves forward to Robert Lowell, right? People are not writing anything remotely close to science fiction. And he comes in with that, plus the fact that, as he says, I have no degree whatsoever ever. He literally does not even have an undergraduate degree because he had been studying at Cornell. I think he was a junior. In his junior year, they said he was flunking all of his classes. He decided, you know what? I have an opportunity to serve my country. I may as well just go to war. It's way better than just failing another round of classes at Cornell. And he was a science major at the time, I think. But also working on the newspaper, writing hilarious stuff, of course, and satirical, getting into trouble with administration, of course. But then he goes to war and experiences what would go into Slaughterhouse-Five, Schlachtfuss-Fünf, as they say in German. And that would be, the bombing of Dresden that would go into the book that he then wrote at the workshop. Really, he comes to the workshop, though, with no undergrad degree because he never finished at Cornell. He's surrounded by people with at least undergraduate degrees who are professional writers in literary fiction. Again, he's out of that category, too. So he has this like profound inferiority complex coming in. And he also doesn't know how to teach to save his life. So he's teaching people how to do creative writing, like using golf metaphors.
You say that Kurt Vonnegut finally realized that he could take what he was already doing and elevate it.
And I think that's where you see something like Slaughterhouse-Five, which has the conventions of science fiction, but clearly is resonating on a almost a universal level. As great world-class literature. And he finds his stride right there at the workshop and flourishes. It's quite an amazing story. The turnaround is extraordinary, but I think his work too with his students, his inspiration from John Irving and the folks they called the Vonnegut people, which was this following that he had. Fiercely defensive of him and very, very much angry when anybody called him a science fiction hack. They inspired him too. So he came along. He definitely he became Kurt Vonnegut in Iowa.
Paul Engel, he seems to have really been the architect of the Writers' Workshop. He raised money for the program when it got no state money. He was out working with publishers, helping people get published. He was, some said he was almost like an agent almost for people in their writing. Mm-hmm. But that there was some criticism of that because people said this is not what we do in literature. You're out, is this commercialized? Mm-hmm. But truly, if you mm-hmm. go there and spend that time and try to become a better writer, I mean, you want to publish, right?
Well, yes. I mean, absolutely. He sort of said the and did the very indecorous thing of assuming that money mattered when it came to literature, and that professional careers mattered when it came to literature. And these were things you just didn't discuss, you know, in the very polite world of belles lettres. You know, you would never bring that up. It's sort of like saying, you know, who picked up the check at the Last Supper? You know, I mean, you don't do that. And so it's anathema to the ethos of the literary world to be as aggressive a marketer of the Iowa brand and of his own students' careers. I mean, he really was over the top in some cases. I mean, he would, in some situations with a fellow named Charles Embry, he literally took one of his stories that Embry submitted for class credit during one of the graduate seminars and just went ahead and submitted it to Esquire magazine without telling the student. And then he came back and very theatrically waved a royalty check in the air and said, look what I have, you know, it's Esquire money and it's from a story written for this class, you know, and people would go, what, you know, what did you do? And, you know, of course, okay, thank you. But, you know, look at how aggressive that is. And so he definitely, and part of it was that aggression that he became notorious for that attracted so much controversy. It came about because he began to run the workshop very autonomously, became his own kind of fiefdom. He admitted and recruited students and even provided fellowships for them totally by his own efforts. He would go and get the money for the fellowships, for the graduate student funding, all himself. And I mean, he was going to a man of refrigeration. He was going to a financial sources like an ice cream company in Chicago to support, you know, a festival on Baudelaire that he wanted to have at school. I mean, it was profound the places he was going to, and it definitely crossing lines into corporate America that people just didn't see. So,
but did Paul Engle go out and get all this money because he wasn't getting any money from the school in the first place? I mean, did he feel like he had to do that?
The administration wasn't going to give him a dime to begin with. He had to take these leftover buildings from World War II to even house the creative writing program. And before that, like I had mentioned, I mean, it's all those workshop sessions are being held in one of the faculty's homes. I mean, there's just literally no physical space even for it, let alone fellowship money, right, for graduate stipends. So I think it's a bad combination of the university not giving him money so that he continues to rely on his own efforts, on his own resources. And so he becomes so autonomous, so sort of autocratic then in running that workshop that I think administration then starts to think, well, he's not part of us. He's not under our umbrella. And has developed too much power on his own. And indeed, that's pretty much where it evolved from, was this administration just not wanting to ante up to help him out. And when you look at his paltry salary over the years, the fact that he paid for his own travel everywhere, it's pretty clear that he was not in it for personal profit or wealth, but really to make Iowa rule the literary world. And he had this ambition that he stated in one of his letters to President Virgil Hancher, and said as much. He really said, look, I want all roads in literature to come through Iowa. And believe it or not, it happened. So pretty miraculous.
You know, I guess finally, looking at the Writers' Workshop today and other writing programs, is Paul Engle's legacy still felt there?
He was that controversial that the graduate students today don't read his poetry. They don't talk about him. He's basically gone from any conversation in the workshop now. And it's fascinating that he was the architect of it. In so many ways, not just financially, but I think pedagogically too, to the extent that workshop today is run in a very, very competitive environment.